Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Yeah, hey TERFs and trannies. This is Nina Paley, co-host of Heterodorks.
And this is Corinna Cohn. And Nina, I'm going to start planning a walkout now because I can't believe you just called me a tranny. I'm going to write a letter to the CEO of Heterodorks and demand that I be treated right.
Wait, I didn't call you a tranny. I said, hey, TERFs and trannies. Maybe I called you a TERF. Maybe I wasn't even talking to you. You ever think of that?
You know what? For this week, I'm going to invite an expert in grievances, a heterodork named Andrew Pessin. And hopefully he'll take my side on this issue. Welcome, Andrew.
I've been around the block once or twice enough to know that I shouldn't take sides on anybody else's issues, generally speaking. Uh-oh, that's probably the wrong thing to say also.
Yeah, you're not on our side. Nice. Well, we are so happy to have Professor Pessin here. Is that correct? Is that how you pronounce it?
Close enough. I've been called worse often.
He has just released. You've released the book. You've released.
It's released, yes.
Satirical novel about, campus culture called Nevergreen.
Oh, I just happen to have a copy right here. What do you know?
That's beautiful, but we're not recording video.
Oh, we're not video. Okay, never mind.
But he held up a copy, so it's real. I can vouch for it.
That's right. And you can find it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, we're going to make show notes. Yes.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay,
but anyway, I finished the book, and Corinna hasn't quite, so I was discussing how the book ended, which is really my first question for you.
Well, if people haven't read it, then you might be spoiling it.
What do we do with spoilers? I'll follow your direction on that.
We edit later.
Okay. Well, as an expert in grievances, is that what you called me? I'm sure people will feel aggrieved if they're spoilers. But on the other hand, I'm okay with spoilers in general. I don't mind knowing the ending of something in advance because anything worth watching, typically, as soon as you finish it, you want to watch it again, right? Because once you know how it ends, then you can really understand it the second time through. So I've never had an issue with spoilers. I don't mind them. I recognize some people do, however.
Yay! You're my kind of author. I actually agree with you. I don't mind spoilers either. The book ends with an epilogue, which is by the protagonist's wife, to whom he is referring throughout the story, which, by the way, is well written and a very enjoyable read. So the spoiler should not turn anyone off from that pleasure.
Thank you. What made you go right to the afterword, I believe it's called? What made you go right to that?
Because she is questioning whether the fictional events in the fictional story happened to the fictional protagonist. So we have this whole story where you know that it's fiction, or it's satirical fiction, but still, it reads like a story. And then at the end, you have this fictional, but did it really happen in this fictional world questioning. So I was like, well, is this, because it's a satirical novel, is the epilogue asking us to question our participation in these cancel culture events? Like, is our paranoia driving a lot of this? Like, are the inmates running the asylum, or are paranoid visitors being so paranoid and easily triggered by the creepy events happening on campuses that were more frightened by what's happening than is merited?
So, wow, talk about jumping right into the deepest end of the pool there. You went right for it. So it's a fantastic question. And I corrected you. It's not an epilogue. I said it's an afterword, but I actually just double checked. It's called The Last Word. That's how I made a mistake myself. Because, of course, his wife typically gets the last word in their argument. So she gets the last word in the book. I could talk fairly at length about this issue. So I'll take your guidance. You stop me or interrupt me, or I'll occasionally pause to breathe and feel free to like redirect if that's best. But so of course, the story of the book, the plot line is this very ordinary guy, not an academic, by a chance encounter gets this invitation to really, it's the opportunity of a lifetime. The life that he didn't choose, but maybe should have, was that of an academic. He gets invited to come give a lecture at a college. He goes off to this college. It's a very strange place. And as it turns out, nobody shows up for his lecture, but that doesn't stop it from becoming the center of a whole firestorm of controversy, which basically results in him apparently running for his life as an example of cancel culture. They're coming after him and maybe even want to kill him and maybe even want to eat him, possibly, depending on how you interpret what's going on there. So that's the basic plot line. But then without giving the spoiler of whether he survives this episode, the last word, the afterword or the epilogue of the book is from the perspective of his wife, who is reflecting back on what she's heard of this from him. And as Nina pointed out, it's raising the question of whether these things happened the way he seemed to describe them as happening. So one thing we learn in the afterword is that, in fact, the narrative voice, the narrator, isn't the omniscient third-person narrator, but it's the character himself who's essentially narrating the story that you've been reading. That isn't, I think, apparent, or it's not explicit anyway, throughout the main body of the book. But you learn that in the afterword, that you're hearing the story as he's telling it, as opposed to hearing it as it actually happened. Now, why is that important? It's important, I think, for a whole bunch of reasons. I'll maybe just mention one, and then I'll breathe. It's important because if there's a theme of the book, it's that when people are gripped by an ideology, and all of us are susceptible to it, and not just the crazy ones who are perhaps being lampooned in this book or satirized in this book, but even we normals, I don't know, is normal a word you're allowed to say? I'm not sure. But we people who don't consider ourselves crazy, let's say, when you're gripped by an ideology, or when you're gripped by a set of concepts that you organize your life by, then you're going to perceive the world through that lens. And it becomes a question then of whether you're perceiving objectively or correctly, et cetera. And so the point that's being made there is we begin to realize that maybe not everything happened quite the way that he has described it along the way. It's meant to show that even the person who's outside the system is going to frame the story in a way that fits with his view of the world. And therefore, it's not just the crazies who are crazies, but maybe the non-crazies are also sort of in the same boat. And it's established actually quite early on. So if you were to go back and reread it from the beginning, not that I'm sure you have more valuable things to do with your time, but if you were to go back and read it from the beginning, you would see actually from chapter one, it's established that he's not necessarily a reliable narrator.
Oh, I got that. I got that the first time. He keeps changing his story, right? Like he uses hyperbole, and he talks about really egregious things happening, and then he revises them or is like, maybe not quite like that.
Yeah. And he actually, just in chapter one, he starts off, I can't remember the specific examples now, but he's describing what's happened, but then he adds that a whole other conversation happened that he hadn't reported. And so you realize there's things happening he's not reporting, and that what he is reporting isn't necessarily accurate. So it's trying to make that point that we're all subject to this. And one of the ways it plays off in the contemporary sort of political scene around campuses, and I don't know how closely you folks watch the campus.
I live on a campus. I live in Urbana, Illinois, home of the University of Illinois, and was canceled in my town thanks to the efforts of people at the University of Illinois.
I'm so sorry. So I don't know. I don't think I know that history. So if you want to talk about it, I'm really curious.
And also thanks to one of the leaders of this is a graduate of Evergreen.
Oh, how interesting that. So no wonder you might take to this story. So, but the point is there are a lot of people out there who are saying that this thing called cancel culture is overblown. It's not really so bad. It's not really so important. It's not really so widespread. And, you know, I do want to make the point that the people who are very critical of campuses, they have their own agendas and ideologies too, right? So it's not just, I mean, the sort of the oversimplified way to put this is many American, North American campuses are really, you know, deeply progressive places. And there's much of value about that. But the storyline is that these progressive places are the source of this cancel culture. But the book is also making the point that the people who are critical of the progressive places have their own ideology, right? And they're going to see things through their lens, and they're going to see as atrocious what can also be seen as very positive by the people who are on the other side. So I want to make the point that nobody is immune from this problem of being gripped by an ideology and having a distorted vision of things. And it's made by realizing that the narrator of the story you just read, maybe things didn't happen quite the way that he puts them. Maybe he's exaggerating. He's prone to hyperbole. He's a little bit neurotic. So he, you know, he's got a lot of anxiety. And maybe what happened on that campus isn't so bad as he has certainly let it out to be.
Well, my own experience as a cancelee is that it was very traumatic, and I was aware of it. I was aware of like a lot of work that I had done in my life to recover from childhood trauma got undone by that. So I could tell that my own thinking was becoming distorted in ways that were, you know, going to be harmful to me because, you know, if I did that splitting thing, right? Like it's very, trauma makes you want to split. Good or bad, they're for you, they're against you. You do get paranoid. And I don't think I indulged too much, but that was definitely like a natural response to that, right?
You know, it's one of the goals of the book. So I have my own experience of cancellation, which I won't really talk about. And I don't know any of the details of yours. So maybe I'd be curious if you're interested in sharing.
Did they try to blow up your house?
What was that?
Did they try to blow up your house?
I have to tell you, my own experience happened when the house got blown up, and there were people who wanted the FBI to get involved to see if it was involved, which I have no reason to believe that it was. I happen to believe it was a horrible coincidence that these two events occurred at the same time, you know, as well as the brain tumor of my wife. So it was a trifecta, basically. One of the things I want to get across is how the subjective experience of being canceled, it is dreadful. You know, if you just read about a story, it's like, oh, a big, you know, mountain out of a molehill. It's a tempest in a teacup or something like that. You know, most people don't realize, unless you're targeted yourself, you don't realize how dreadful it is to have just people piling on you. It's a, you know, massive form of bullying. There's usually a very large cyber component, the cyberbullying of it. As you were saying with the splitting, you know, people who you think are your friends, suddenly they have to make a stand. Like they're either with you or they're not with you, right? Like when you're being attacked, the true friend, even if maybe what you did or said was questionable or a little offensive or something like that, you know, the scope of the response is so disproportionate typically to the offense in question, I think. And the person who did it, even if they feel they made a mistake and want to apologize, you really feel like essentially they're coming after you. And and to be canceled is to be eliminated, not metaphorically, obviously, but if they're blowing up your house, you know, or in particular, when your voice and your perspective and your presence is being eliminated, literally on these campuses, right? They want you off the campus. They want you silenced. It feels like they're coming after you, like a mob is coming after you, which is, of course, what's going on in the story in this book. So I was trying to get across to simply what it feels like. And it feels terrible. It's horrible. It's a trauma. It's an assault. You feel like you are being tracked down by murderous cannibals who really want to destroy you. And once, hopefully, people, if there's an activist agenda of this book, I don't know that there is, but if there is, once people appreciate how dreadful cancellation is, I hope the next step is to realize it has no place, certainly in life in general, but certainly on a campus. A campus is supposed to be a very special kind of community. And in my view, cancellation is so antithetical to what a university is supposed to be about. It has to be stopped. It has to be stopped. That doesn't mean I can digress in a lot of ways there. But so that's what I want to do, get across how awful it is. And it is awful. And anyone who's experienced knows how awful it is. And people who haven't experienced it, I don't think appreciate how awful it is.
All right, I want to hear your cancellation story now. Is that okay, Corinna? Can we?
I'm actually, I'm not at liberty to discuss it on the air, so I'm sorry. But, you know, you can Google me, and, you know, what you will discover happily is 95% of the coverage was in my favor, because, of course, the truth was on my side, is how I put it. So, but you'll also see some of the coverage on the other side of it. So feel free to Google, find out yourself.
Yeah, the truth, in my case, truth was just completely irrelevant. But I didn't have a position at the campus. I just had my reputation as an artist.
Yeah.
And that just flew all over the place. It flew all over town, flew all over the internet, flew internationally. I had international screenings canceled. And they went after my movie, which I had just released.
Which so, is fantastic. I watched it after we connected, and I'm so impressed by it. And maybe we can talk about in particular that the scene that you highlighted, which I think is really the most brilliant part of it. The My Land stuff. This land is mine, which is just is so powerful because I want to disagree with it actually on many levels. And yet, of course, I can't. But in any case, yeah, right. Your reputation is attacked. And
my film, it's like my poor little film that had nothing to do with this. This is because on Facebook, I reposted a song that a friend of mine had written, "If a person has a penis, he's a man." Mm. And like,
that's
it. That was it. That was the end. It's like Nina she hates trans people and she's transphobic and she's a white supremacist and she's into genocide. And then the really ironic thing was we tried to get the local art theater. A new friend of mine tried to get the film shown for Passover at the local art theater. And I became the only filmmaker in the entire world to be banned by the local art theater on Passover. So my rather savvy friend made a point of pointing out that the town was, you know, censoring Jews on Passover. But that was also a way that I learned that like being Jewish has no liberal cachet anymore.
Oh, it's the opposite. No, to be Jewish is to be targeted. Jews are being canceled on campuses. So I don't know if you noticed or if I sent you, the book basically has a secret Jewish angle. It's actually all about the Jews, even though it doesn't mention Jews explicitly at all. It's because I do believe that basically Jews are being canceled from campuses. I believe, I don't know if you want to go this way or not, so feel free to redirect, but you know, the whole BDS movement is an effort to cancel Jewish identity on campuses. BDS.
Could I just establish?
Yes.
Briefly, even though I have a Jewish last name, my mom is not Jewish, so please do not cancel me.
Okay. But it's okay if we get canceled? Is that what you're saying? Because,
Well, yeah, you Jews.
Yeah,
whatever
right.
happens to you guys.
Yeah, it's not happening to you. I don't, you know.
Yeah, it's not happening to me.
You know,
and I'm not that worried anyway because I've got tranny armor.
Yeah. Well, first they came for the Jews, and then they stopped because they really only wanted the Jews, is I think how it goes. I don't have a Jewish last name, but yes, I'm in unmistakably Jewish. I don't know. I can't tell. But in any case, so the book is really all about the cancellation of the Jews. But of course, the cancellation of the Jews is wrapped into the larger process of cancel culture. So they're going to cancel people who don't even, you know, you don't even assert something. You just merely share maybe something that was interesting, even if you may or may not agree with it, you know, that, but if you don't follow the party line, goodbye. And if you're a Jew, even worse, right? Even worse.
Well, let me ask you, Andrew,
yeah.
because it seems to me the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League,
yeah.
is in league with the people who have the mentality that cancellation is a good way of eliminating from society people who have undesirable points of view.
I agree. So the ADL, you know, in my circles, the ADL has been worse than useless. It's been harmful because the ADL. So I don't know anything about your politics, so I'm probably stepping into all sorts of things now, but okay, let's go for it. I'm a very respectful person, so just putting that out there. Please don't cancel me. But the ADL.
I'm respectful, you assholes.
Yeah, right. You know, the ADL, whatever, you know, work it's done in the past has really thrown its lot in with the sort of the radical progressive movement. And it's much more concerned about typical progressive causes than it really is about Jews. And in, this is my opinion and that of others I hang out with, many of them. And indeed, you know, it will fight anti-Semitism as long as it's coming from an identifiable right-wing source. You know, when the white supremacists are anti-Semitic, the ADL is all over that. But the reality is, in our culture and world today, the far more dangerous anti-Semites, in my opinion, are the radical progressivists, generally speaking. It doesn't mean all of them, obviously, but the progressive movement in general is really profoundly anti-Semitic, in my view. And the ADL only fights right-wing anti-Semitism and wants to fit in with those folks. So that's my understanding of your comment there, which is it's in league with the people who are really the most dangerous anti-Semites. So,
well, it could also be said, Zionists, up until, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, but some Zionists were very aggressively canceling people prior to what we call cancel culture. And I know that you're, you know, you and I are like, you can tell from my film that we're somewhat different in terms yeah. of Zionism. But when I was making my movie, friends of mine were like, oh my God, the Zionists are going to be so mad. It's going to be so offensive to them. They're going to be, and nothing happened. It was just like crickets.
Yeah.
But I ended up getting canceled because I said penises are male.
Right.
Not in the movie. And I just had this idea that there's some sort of law of conservation of evil or outrage or something. And it just moved. It moved from this one issue to this other yeah. issue. But I do find that the cancel people get their rhetoric straight from the Anti-Defamation League.
I don't know. They get their rhetoric from the Anti-Defamation League?
Yeah, in terms yeah. of... Oh, they do. They do. There. What was that website that we saw, Corinna? There was some...
It's the Triangle of Hate.
That's right. The Triangle of Hate.
And who
we'll put that in the show notes.
Who are the components of the Triangle of Hate, dare I ask? Like, what are the three vertices of that triangle? Do we
Let
know?
Let me see yeah. if I can.
Yeah.
Are you looking it up? Yeah.
Well, it has a base. If you're listening, stop everything that you're doing.
Oh, this is the Triangle of Hate?
And open the show notes. This is the... Right.
Oh, so I've seen this.
The triangle... At the base are things like belittling jokes and justifying biases by seeking out like-minded people. How dare you seek out like-minded people, you bigots?
Yeah.
Moving up, individual acts of prejudice, such as ridicule, which is sometimes called humor, slurs and epithets, but not turf. That's not a slur. Name-calling. Then it moves up to discrimination. Bias motivated violence like arson, Andrew.
Yeah.
And then the top of the pyramid is genocide.
Yeah.
And when I saw this pyramid, I have to tell you, the thing that it reminded me of was the FDA, like how to plan your healthy meal.
No, they have a pyramid too. I think yeah. you're right. No. And there's also like, what is it? The 8 steps of grief, you know, there's lots of things that we could compare this to, but you know, this also just looks plausible on the surface of it. Like things start off on a low level and the low level sort of waters the ground to prepare the next level. And, you know, you could see it if you look at the way, you know, Nazi Germany dehumanized the Jews prior. You can't just like come in office and start the genocide right away. You have to build up to it. And this is roughly the kind of steps that a party would take towards building up to genocide. So it seems to me like this is, you know, in the ballpark of plausible.
It is, but like you said earlier, everybody has an ideology that distorts. And so everybody
yeah.
is seeing everybody else as the Nazi.
Well, yeah. Which, of course, is crazy, right? Because only a handful of people really will ever get to the genocide level of that chart. That's pretty unique. But we are at a stage of like hysteria, which is... If you disagree with me, you're a Nazi. That's kind of the feeling that captures campus culture. And you could understand, like, if there were actual Nazis on campus, and in some places there are, like the neo-Nazi movement is real and it does infiltrate some campuses periodically. When there's a Nazi on campus, yeah, all right, that person needs to be canceled. That person needs to be removed. We can understand that. But the hysteria is at this much lower level when people have a different perspective from me. I'm just, you know, I'm so moved by your case. If that was the cause of your cancellation, like the outrage is just goes through the roof because, and I don't even know what your opinion is. Again, you were just sharing something that might've been interesting and not necessarily even defending it, who knows? But even if you're defending it, why can't you have that opinion without being accused of genocide, right?
Because it leads to genocide. You saw the pyramid.
But there's so many steps from there to the, like, you know, cut some slack. So there's this great concept, the concept of a staged emergency. So I can't remember the woman who coined this phrase five or 6 years ago, but she was looking at campuses and, you know, most campuses are just these lovely, wonderful places to be, especially if you're like one of the more prestigious campuses. These are places that are loaded with money. The campuses are comfortable. You've got fantastic dorm rooms. You've got rec rooms. You've got great food in the cafeteria. Like, these are places of privilege, if any place is a place of privilege. And yet the students are regularly hysterical about all the oppression and bias and quote unquote violence that they face, right? And there's something crazy about that. The campuses are about the safest communities you can imagine, the most privileged communities. And yet these students are freaking out at how terrible their lives are on these campuses. So this woman coined this phrase, you know, it's a staged emergency and it's this hysteria, which of course is the same thing as, or at least produces the cancel culture. If I have a Nazi on campus, I have to get rid of that person. That I understand. I can go along with that.
I don't know. I think one Nazi.
Maybe like, one Nazi, right? But what? I get it. I get why that voice maybe needs to be removed. But the reality is, except for the handful of actual Nazis that are out there, what you really have are differences of opinion, and sometimes they're serious differences of opinion. I can understand how even the idea that, you know, if you have a penis, you're male, I could see how that could be connected through a chain of thoughts to people who might be violent towards trans people. Like, but there's a bunch of steps between expressing that thought and the person who's actually a threat, I think, to trans people. But when you're in this mode of hysteria, then the difference of opinion itself is violence to you. And that's, to be crazy, because it isn't. We need to make some distinctions and we need to not be hysterical. And especially at a university, because a university, you would think, I read this somewhere, that universities are in the business of pursuing truth and knowledge. I don't remember where I read that crazy thought. And the way you pursue truth and knowledge is bare minimum necessity is you allow divergent opinions to come to the table to talk it out and argue and reason, right? And if you silence somebody, then you're not merely silencing that perspective. You are obstructing the quest for truth and knowledge, which is the mission of the university. When we're in this frame of mind, this cancellation frame of mind, it is really, it's undermining the whole educational process. It's really, that's the emergency, and it's not a staged emergency. It's a real emergency in my view. And so that's why I wrote this book, because I want to get across to people that what's going on a lot of campuses, too many campuses, not all campuses, but many campuses, and many of especially the more prestigious and more well-known campuses, is really the ending of the academy as we know it or as it ought to be. And it's going to cause such harm, I think, to the long-term health of this country and the world. I mean, I think it's that important if it isn't addressed and addressed very soon.
You said something that I think is incorrect about the purpose of universities.
Okay.
It's to turn a profit. They're revenue streams. Oh, Corinne has something to say.
Okay.
Yes, you're wrong, Nina.
Oh.
But
wait,
but
am I right then?
You're not right either.
We're both wrong. Okay.
But your book gets it right.
Oh.
So the book Nevergreen gets this right, but you misspoke. If you don't mind me correcting you,
I'm happy to be corrected.
All right. You said that universities are in the business of knowledge and education.
I said I read that somewhere once. So I just
you read that somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. I'm retweeting that thought. Doesn't necessarily mean I endorse it, but go on. Continue.
Well, I think your book makes this point that universities are really in the business of transferring wealth from students to administrators.
I'll go with that. I can put my name on that petition. You know, there's it's possible to become very cynical about universities. And I think that's coming out now a little bit. So, you know, when I'm in my more idealistic phase, I really am attracted to the idea that universities are about the pursuit of truth and knowledge. And I think that's in their mission statements, typically. It's what they say they're in the business of. And to be fair, we have to also keep, you know, a little bit of perspective. It's cancel culture. It's not like every campus is beset by everybody canceling everybody else, right? What you have are pretty much typically vocal minorities who are very loud and they call a lot of attention to themselves, but you still have plenty of students who are going to schools to learn, right? And do the right thing, do the thing you're supposed to do. So I think this truth and knowledge thing, it is happening. It's not like it doesn't happen at all. But it gets lost certainly in the very loud noise that these fanatic minority are making it. So that's one point. Point number two, there's no question this is something that was deliberate in the book, so thank you for catching it, which is that it is certainly mocking the administrative bloat that occurs on campuses. And, you know, the cost of higher education, colleges have gone through the roof way beyond the rate of inflation for several decades now. And there's a lot of reasons for that, apparently, including the easy availability of student loans. So basically, once the government made it easy to borrow money to go to school, schools just raised their rates. And so that's essentially a transfer of wealth, like right from the government, i.e. the taxpayer into the pocket of the university. So absolutely right. And, you know, where schools have bloated, now coming back more directly to our issue, schools have become bloated by hiring administrators over the last couple of decades. It's crazy how many deans there are at so many schools. And, you know, the ratio of deans per student is extraordinarily high. I'm going to guess the highest it's ever been in its history. And that reflects also some interesting changes, I think, in the way university conceives of its customers. I mean, its students, which is that I think in the old days, I don't know when this is, but at some previous point in, you know, far back misty history, students would come to a university and the assumption was that, you know, the professors knew stuff. They were older. They'd been studying for a long time. They were professionals in their areas of interest. The professors knew stuff and students knew not very much. And the goal was something like transferring knowledge from, you know, the professor to the student. And on that model, you know, the student is really working for the professor. It's like the professor is the employer who's training the employee, something along those lines. But in the last couple of decades, that really has switched to now where the student is the customer and the professor is the employee. And the most important thing, or at least a very important thing, has become you really have to cater to the whims and desires and interests and needs and welfare of the students. So it used to be, you know, you came to the college and if you could do well, great. If you couldn't cut it, you couldn't cut it. You were out. But that's no longer allowed. So now the student as a customer is essentially always right. And amongst the reasons for this administrative bloat, I believe, is that we really need to take care of the mental health of and the welfare and the needs of our students. So you have, you know, deans of student affairs and things like that. And you have this incredible amount of money that's gone into renovating dorms, and they have to have, obviously, have to have high-speed Wi-Fi now, that's obvious. But you know, places have unbelievable athletic facilities, and they've got game rooms, and they've got just beautiful campuses, because now you have to make the students happy. So maybe that's the way to put it. In the old model, the student had to make the professor happy, basically, right? But in this model, the professor and the administrators, the administration, have to make the students happy. And that's a big change. I don't know that it's a positive change.
They're failing too. The students have never been less happy. And here at the University of Illinois, you know, it's all this discussion of how poor their mental health is. Meanwhile, they built all these fancy condos for students and they all have cars. So I grew up in this town.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And right. We used to bike and walk. And they don't do that now, they drive. But there's all this evidence that walking, just walking between your classes, is really good for mental health and processing ideas. And it's like, you could solve so many of these mental health problems by just have them walk and bike. It's really good for your brain, especially when you're digesting something that just happened in a class.
Yeah, you know,
that is just so ableist, Nina.
Oh, I was about to make a joke, but that would certainly have gotten me into trouble. So I for once in my rarely in my life have I managed to censor myself before I spoke, and I just did it there. It, you know, I don't know that I've even seen that thought that, you know, the amount of money that's poured into student welfare has produced students whose welfare is so impaired. That's, could it be that the money that's going into welfare is cause, is partly causing that problem, right? Like, I wonder. One of my favorite parts of the book, I don't know if Karina, you've gotten to that part yet, but you know, there's a character, this kid is called the Kernel of Truth. I borrowed this. So several of the scenes are taken from, you know, real life, from real episodes. So I don't know if you remember the, she earned the moniker, the Screaming Girl from Yale University a few years back over the Halloween controversy. Mm-hmm. Is that familiar to you? So for those who are not familiar, just briefly, this was probably 2015, I think, maybe 2016 at the latest, but basically there was a controversy over Halloween costumes and cultural appropriation on Halloween at Yale. And this young woman in the courtyard, I went to Yale as an undergraduate. So this young woman in the courtyard of Silliman College, which is one of the residential colleges there, one of the dorms there, accosted what used to be called the master of the house, but I think they've gotten rid of that language now. But she accosted him, who's a wonderful, brilliant, dignified man, Nicholas Christakis, I think is his name. Anyway, this, of course, this was caught on video, so it went viral. And she's just screaming at him and cursing at him. And that one of the key issues, it's a really beautiful moment. I urge people to go Google this and find this thing for a number of reasons. But one, she yells at him that his goal as a master, his job as the master, so to speak, of this residential college is to provide a home for people. And insofar as he was taking the wrong view on the Halloween costumes, which was basically supporting an email that his wife had sent saying, people, you're freaking out about Halloween costumes and it's okay if you get a little offended by someone. You don't, you know, it's not the end of the world. We shouldn't be policing Halloween costumes. We should let students be autonomous and make their own decisions. And if they make bad decisions, they'll get the feedback, but like, let's stop all the Halloween stuff. So because the Nicholas was supporting his wife there, this woman was screaming at him that she was not comfortable in this dorm that she lived in. And he was failing in his job to create a home, an environment. And he said, it's really such a crucial line. He said to her with this quiet dignity, she's again screaming and cursing at him. And she's just said to him, you don't understand, right? And he says, I do understand. I just disagree. So quietly and with such dignity. And it really captures everything because that's right. They disagree on what the function of this place should be. She's out of control screaming at him. And he recognizes, you know what, you know, you can disagree without screaming at a person. So she's cancel culture in full mode. And he is sort of the voice of reason there in a lovely way. And then to give him a little bit more credit too, this video went viral, and I think this poor woman got a lot of abuse. She got canceled by people who thought she was outrageous. And Nicholas Christakis put out a statement saying, urging people that you shouldn't judge someone based on a 30-second excerpt from their life where maybe they weren't at their best or something like that. It was like this beautiful moment where he said, don't do to her what she was trying to do to us and do to me here. And he was absolutely right, because I watched this video and my first reaction was that I thought that woman was unhinged, right? Like crazy screaming girl from Yale is what the video was typically called. And he sort of gave me a nice check back to reality, which is, you know what? I'm not going to make any judgment about that person whatsoever. I don't agree with the way she was behaving there, but you know, I'm not going to be essentialist about her. That was just 30 seconds of her life. For all I know, she's the most wonderful human being in the world, and I'm not going to judge her. So I thought that was an important corrective. Point of all that was, I borrowed that scene, and of course it occurs in the novel, and the kernel of truth is, in this case, this sort of crazy student himself is the voice of reason here, and you have this cancellation thing going. The students are outraged that hate has come to their campus in the name of this poor narrator whose lecture they didn't even hear. But in their mind, he's become he represents hate, and he's on their campus and they're freaking out and they're screaming and they're yelling like, are my friends, they can't go to classes, they can't sleep, they're freaking out. And he just reproaches them, says, you know, that's really not normal. We have this unbelievably fantastic campus. You were just mentioning these great dorm rooms. We've got fantastic food. We've got a state-of-the-art facilities, whether it's athletics or music, et cetera, et cetera. And your friends are freaking out that they don't feel safe, that they're not at home. What? It's crazy. So I borrowed a huge chunk of that dialogue from Screaming Girl herself, actually. So I anyway, but you're right. All this money has been put into attending to the welfare of students, and students are not feeling it, right? They're feeling the opposite. And something is wrong with that system.
Well, I'm sure you've read The Coddling of the American Mind, yeah?
I did read that when it came out, yeah.
Well, you know, of the American mind.
No, I mean, I think that's right. There's a straight line from, you know, I remember, I don't know, was it 10 years ago? You know, people, when was the phrase helicopter parenting and participation trophies? You know, that goes back already a while, 10 or 15 years or more. But it started with that, you know, that generation when we started taking a society, a lot of people took a different attitude towards their children, which they had to be coddled from early childhood onwards. And now those coddled children grow up and they go to colleges. And maybe what we're seeing is the product of a generation of really important changes in parenting philosophy. You know, I remember, you know, I'm a fairly old guy now, but I remember 12, 13, 14 years old, I would ride my bike all over the neighborhood, miles away from home. We didn't have cell phones in those days, you know? And as I look back now, I'm like, how the hell did my mother, why did she let me do that, right? Like, I would never let my kid like ride off and be out of communication for hours at a time. But that was the norm. That was the norm back then. And I myself have been subject to that chain, right? Like, I feel uncomfortable letting my kid be out of my smaller kids when they were smaller, be out of my sight and out of communication. The idea that, like, you know, got them phones so we could know where they are at all times. I don't know that that's so helpful to like the psychology of a parent. And maybe what it's done is it creates in the mind of a kid that they can't fend for themselves and they have to be protected at all times. You know, the phrase curling parent, have you heard that one too? So the helicopter parent was the earlier phrase. That was, you know, parents who are always hovering around their kid, whatever the kid's doing to, you know, help them out and make sure they go okay. The curling parent, then that phrase replaced helicopter parent. You know, the that weird Canadian sport, curling, where you're, right, where you're this puck is sliding across the ice and people are sweeping the ice, I guess, to direct where the puck goes. So now parents are curling. We're like always in front of our kids and we're clearing the obstacles away so that they can succeed. And you know, I'm subject to that too. I'm not blaming others when I say that. My own parenting is much more in that category. But when I step back from it, I say, am I producing a kid who can take care of himself when I do that? If I'm taking care of everything for them, and even to the point, I'm opening up, self-criticizing here our parenting skills. Our oldest is almost 16. And until this year, we were still making his lunches for school because you start off making their lunches when they're 5 years old and you just keep going. It's like, and you can rationalize it to yourself. You say to yourself, well, he could make his lunch, but it'll take longer. He'll make a big mess and it won't be as good. It's just easier. I'll just do it. Right. So you keep making his lunch. And it wasn't until really he was 15 years old. We said, you know what? We're not doing him any favors by making his lunch because then he's going to get to college and he won't know how to make lunch. He doesn't know how to cook anything because we cook everything for them. And so it was a real awakening. And it took until he was 15 before we realized all along we thought we're helping him. We're helping our kids by doing things for them. But we're actually not in the long run. We're harming them because we're making it harder for them to really fend for themselves. And unfortunately, in life comes a point where you're out there on your own and you got to fend for yourself. And so I think, I'm not blaming parents who've done this. At least I understand it because I've done it myself. I'm guilty of it. A whole generation of this has produced kids who can't handle hearing a word that disagrees with their view of the world. And it's hard not to imagine the speculative causal theory here, but it's hard not to imagine there's some straight line between making lunches for your kid until they're 18 and a kid, you know, being unable to hear a word that disagrees with him without freaking out. So there you have it. That's the state of the campus today for too many students.
There's really a straight line between making lunches for your kid until they're 16 and genocide.
I think so. It should be on that chart. So the bottom chart is you make lunch for the kid until they're 16 and they're 15. And then the next step is genocide.
In fact, this is the way to combine the pyramid of hate with the food pyramid.
It's perfect. That's genius. I'm going to get to work on that, right? If I had artistic skills, I would actually generate that after this conversation.
So I don't want to roll over Corinna if you have something to ask, but I wanted to talk to you about scapegoats. Cause when I was being canceled, Also because I had similar experiences when I was young and pondered my role as a scapegoat when I was a child. I was a scapegoat in my family and I was a scapegoat at school. And, you know, then I wasn't a scapegoat for a long time. And then there I was again, being a scapegoat. So I thought long and hard about what are scapegoats and why do people need scapegoats? Like, I really see it as something that is not actually that personal, that it's really about the community, and the community needs to discharge energy by finding scapegoats.
God, you ask, these are deep questions, I guess.
But, you know. But since you're into the, you know, right. the junior, you like, you know, we could talk about like the real scapegoats.
You got a philosopher on the line, so why not, right? great. So
I mean, course, I actually thought I did all this Old Testament reading to make sadomasochism.
Yeah, clearly.
And you know, the story of the binding of Isaac is often interpreted as this great innovation, this great step forward for civilization, where they were no longer doing human sacrifice.
Right.
And the scapegoat, I think, is a similar innovation, where tribes just naturally do this to their members, that there's some like magic, some primal magic that happens when you eject a member of your own tribe, and that by using a goat, they were just like with the Isaac story, they were replacing the human sacrifice with a goat, but that people, that whatever compels us to do that is deep, deep in our nature.
Yeah. So the connection, just for your listeners, right? There is a connection to the book because, you know, it's easy to see the main character who goes by the initial J, so J period. It's easy to see him as a scapegoat. And indeed, that's one of the themes throughout the book. The administrators keep trying to tell him, well, it's not really about you. And, you know, at one point, the students have, you know, put up a photo of his face and they're like, well, that's not you. And, you know, it's just someone who looks like you or something like that. They keep wanting to say, it's not really about you. And in some level, the book agrees with that, because after all, they didn't even attend the lecture. They don't even know what he said. So whatever they're doing, they're working out their own ideas and they're projecting it onto him. So there's an element of truth in this, even though, of course, it is a photograph of him they're using as the face of hate, capital F, capital H there. So he is functioning as a kind of scapegoat. He is functioning as someone that is ultimately enables them to satisfy something in themselves, and he just happens to be he's the unfortunate target of it. He's there at the wrong place, wrong time. Now, theories of what scapegoats are all about go all the way back to the Bible. So you were quoting the Bible there, which is, of course, the origin of the scapegoat story, which is part of the ritual, isn't it? Around it is around the high holidays, isn't it? That the high priest confesses. So think about the imagery there, right? The high priest basically takes all the sins of the people and puts them on the head of this goat and then sends the goat off to die. And at least symbolically there, one interpretation, no doubt of many, is that this is a way of expiating, absolving ourselves of our sins by somehow taking what's really bad and problematic or evil and ugly about us and somehow transferring it onto this thing, which we then kill. We're symbolically removing it from ourselves. And maybe that's part of the meaning of the original scapegoat from the Bible. There is a wonderful scholar, I'm not going to be able to reproduce his theory, but René Girard, have you heard that name?
Yes.
René Girard has a whole psychological analysis of scapegoating. And I know during my own particular experience of cancellation, some scholar reached out to me and said, you should read René Girard because what he is exactly describing what's happening to you, he said. So I recommend that for future reading. But you know, it's certainly very similar to Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher. He has a famous book about anti-Semitism, a famous essay on anti-Semitism, and he offers the psychological analysis of the anti-Semite, which he summarizes with the famous line that if the Jew didn't exist, the anti-Semite would have had to invent him, because anti-Semitism, in his and Sartre's analysis, has nothing to do ultimately with anything the Jews actually have done or who they are. It's a whole psychological mechanism that the hater himself is using to relieve his hate. And you know, in a similar way, this character Jay, the response to him is not about anything he said or did. They didn't even hear the talk, right? So it's not about that. It's working out something in them. What that is, I leave to René Girard or Jean-Paul Sartre. They all have different analyses of those things, but it does seem pretty clear when you look at at cancel culture, which is a culture of hatred ultimately, right? So the person being targeted is being accused of being a hater. That's a very big word on campuses these days. Like, hate has no place on a campus, right? Capital H. The person being canceled is being accused of hatred, being accused of genocide, being accused of violence, all those sorts of things. But when you look at the disproportionate response to what they've actually said or done in almost all of these cases, it's hard not to think that it is the accusers who are the haters rather than typically the person being accused. So in what they're doing is transferring their own hatred. They are the haters and they're transferring it onto the target of their hatred and calling that person the hater. So I think it fits really nicely. It really does. I'll stop on there.
Hate sure has a bad rap, given that it's something that everybody does. It's part of being a human. And it's like, if you have humans on campus, you're going to have hate on campus. I recently wrote about this, actually.
I'd love to see that. No, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a thing about loving my enemies. And when I say loving them, I mean, like, being grateful that I have something to hate because I need to.
We all need something to hate. Think how it motivates us, right? And it energizes us. And hate.
I just want to, can I interrupt and just, I want to tell everyone again, I'm not Jewish.
Yes, okay. Got
so
that.
These are the Jews talking about hate. That's where this is going. I am a Gentile. This is where we're at.
You know,
one of us named Cohn is the Gentile.
Yeah, and you are protesting that.
Haley and Pessin are the Jews.
You know, many of the absolute worst Jew haters through history were themselves Jews or converts from Jews. So, you know, the way that you're constantly insisting you're not Jewish makes me really suspect that you might be. So I don't know if you've done a 23andMe or something like that, but I have a feeling you're going to discover some Middle Eastern roots.
I want to do the 23andMe, but it's transphobic.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah, because it'll trace. They will allege that I have a Y chromosome, and they'll trace it that way.
Okay.
And it'll come back saying my results are male, and that's just that's hateful.
What if it just came back and said your results are Y chromosome, but it didn't add the category male to that? Would that be like a more neutral, say,
no,
or is the Y chromosome?
It's still in opposition to my lived experience.
Okay.
Corinna doesn't identify as having a Y chromosome.
That's right. It doesn't exist anymore.
Did you read, I think this was an Onion or Babylon Bee heading, but it was something like motorcyclist who identifies as bicyclist wins the Tour de France.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, that illustrates the point that we started today, which is, I don't know where you stand, on these issues, but I moved to the Y chromosome talk thinking, well, that is value neutral talk, isn't it? At least in principle, like either you have a Y chromosome or you don't have a Y chromosome. But whether or not you want to think of that as male or not, is we have a little more leeway there, it seems to me. But it's people who are so committed to an ideology that will go to the point where you know, they'll deny they have a Y chromosome because they see that as value laden. That seems to be the point where ideology is sort of taking over good sense. But I don't know, maybe you disagree and maybe you've offended me and you're offended by me and you're probably canceling me as we speak.
Speaking of offense, I did want to...
I know, you're not Jewish. Got it.
Twice in the last 2 weeks, I've been in conversations where somebody has said to me this phrase, I don't want to offend anybody. And in both of those conversations, I have said back to them.
Then stop speaking, right?
I think that we ought to be comfortable with the possibility that we're offending people, especially because if you're not offending somebody, you're not igniting anything in their brain to ignite a thought.
Yeah.
If it's just pabulum and you're not saying anything that causes anybody to think about anything, then you're not even saying anything.
You know,
you have to take the risk of being offensive.
No, right. To say anything substantive is to risk offending somebody. You know, a number of surveys have come out lately about how, you know, students on campuses, just to bring it back to this topic, students on campuses are afraid to speak because they're afraid to offend. But as soon as people become afraid to speak, then they're going to be afraid to have real conversations. They're going to be afraid to learn new things. They're going to be afraid to move knowledge or truth forward, right? So it's only got bad consequences. And so we should encourage people to be offensive, I think is what we're saying.
If I taught at a college, I would have a workshop where people role played offending somebody.
I think they do things like that, don't they? Some people do that. I've heard of that.
But it wouldn't, what they have is like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll do better next time. No, and I'm saying it's like you role play having integrity. Right. Where you don't have animosity towards the person that you offended, but you also like maintain your integrity.
I've always
offended somebody.
I've always been attracted to the idea that you should have some space on campus, you know, like a free speech space or where the goal is to be incredibly offensive to everybody, and, you know, as many people as you can be. And that what would happen is, at first, and you have to make it mandatory that people come here and participate in this and experience it. And of course, at first, it's going to be horribly uncomfortable. I can think of things people would say that would make me very uncomfortable. But if it goes on for a while, you get immune to it, right? Like, it's just like, oh, it's just that's the person just saying words and sounds, and it doesn't bother me anymore. And then you can get on with life, right? But we're at the point where we're so afraid to say anything that... that anything we say, we have this emergency reaction to. It's like we need an EpiPen, so in the book, I make one little joke there. Obviously, you can't say the N-word, right? The N-word is out of, and I understand why, right? That word is off the table in terms of public discourse. But in the book, there's now...
Which word?
My book, the N-word. Were you trying to get me to say the N-word? But in the book, there's now
Nevergreen. That's the N word. Nevergreen.
Actually, in the book, the N word is normal, to be honest. So you're not allowed to say normal.
Right.
But they refer to it as the N word. But now there's a movement to eliminate the phrase the N word. Right. So you're not allowed to even say because once you can't say the offending word, then the phrase the N word becomes the substitute for that. And that becomes as offensive as the original word was. So you can't say that either. But that's the point where we are having, you know, it's as if you get a mosquito bite and you have this massive allergic reaction to it. Someone says something that you could just say, oh, yeah, you know, that's kind of offensive, and move on. But instead, you have to stop and have a hysterical reaction and eliminate that person. So we're back to that theme yet again.
Well, I think we can all agree that that's just retarded.
Oh, beautiful. It R word. Nice. Yeah. You brought that in.
Oh.
I was thinking retarded the whole time.
There's
the word retarded.
Socially retarded. Not mentally retarded, socially retarded.
You know,
we are retarding our society by making words magical and making them sinful.
I went on this wonderful program years ago called Semester at Sea, which is basically, I taught on it. It was a college on a ship that goes around the world. And
like that New York Times guy that got canceled for doing that, right? You heard about that?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't know that. I don't know that I heard that.
You can
that.
Get canceled doing those things.
Well, this was just before cancel period started, so I got it in under the gun. But the ship went westward. We left from Vancouver and headed to Japan. But when you go in that direction, like every day or two, you would retard the clocks. Like the clock, you would get an extra hour of sleep, and this was happening like every other day. It was fantastic. But the expression was retarding the clocks. And I don't think anyone was uncomfortable with the word then. I don't think you could say that today. I think on Semester at Sea, they no longer say, you know, don't forget to retard your clock. But I happen to think the R word, I mean, I understand some people find it offensive, but it is such a good word. It's so useful in so many ways. It's a shame that is unfortunately, you know, on the list of words to be canceled. So.
Well, while I was being canceled, I attended something in Quebec City, Canada. So I flew, and the signboards at the airport would list these planes, and then some of them would say en retard.
Right.
which is delayed. It's like, oh, it just means delayed.
It just means delayed. That's all it means.
This plane is retarded.
I know. I want to come back to one thing you said in passing a while ago. So you mentioned Zionist cancellation. And there's no doubt, you know, Zionists, either of the Israeli type or the type who support Israel on American campuses, let's say, they're hardly perfect people, right? There are certainly some bad cases. And there are definitely some people who have been, I think you could use the word canceled, for supporting the Palestinian cause. And so you do hear of those cases. But I think overwhelmingly, just statistically, the cancellation idea is much more prominent on the other side. It is the anti-Zionists who make it literally a policy platform, a policy on their platform to cancel the Zionist voices. And the BDS movement is the boycott, divestment, sanction movement against Israel, is precisely a cancellation movement. So there are instances, I won't deny it, where Zionists have silenced anti-Zionists, but overwhelmingly it's the opposite direction. It's the anti-Zionists silencing the Zionists and proud of it, right? That's proud of it.
Right. Well, now that is the case, but 10 years ago, that was not the case.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Let's say they have power now. The power dynamics have changed. Because there was a time where having a Jewish identity gave you a little bit of liberal cachet.
Yeah.
Right? It was one of these like oppressed identities, and it's not anymore.
Yeah. No, it's not. So Jews are white supremacists now in the minds of most campus activists. And so we are on the oppressor side as opposed to the oppressed. Absolutely.
Right. But it wasn't always this way. And when Jews were more recognized as having some victim clout, I think that Zionists had more power to shut people up and make them really nervous and freak them out. And now there's like a kind of backlash against that. But, you know, there was a time when it actually took some courage to criticize Israel or stand up for Palestinians, or, you know, like it really did. And that's not the case now, right?
Yeah.
Just like there was a time that it took some courage to stand up for your tranny friends, which I certainly did back in the day, but it's completely different now. It's been inverted. And so I've made a lot of changes myself in terms of how I regard trans issues and trans activists, because I've stayed pretty much the same, but the politics have gotten really different. Yeah. And there are people who, you know, 20 years ago, I would have happily referred to Corinna as she or her, she, the chocolate bar that he favors. But as you can tell, I use those masculine pronouns for him now, because this bullshit has gotten out of hand.
So again, I'm walking out.
So, not entering into that specific. Sorry, that's just the medicine alert.
Do you want to go medicate your kid?
No, he's having a seizure, but it's fine. That's a joke. There's no question the power has shifted. I definitely agree with that. I don't think, you know, and it certainly would have taken more courage to stand up and criticize Israel maybe 20 years ago than it does today. You know, absolutely takes no courage whatsoever. The courage is standing up for Israel today. I think that's fairly undeniable. I just don't know that we should equate that with cancel culture. I don't know that it was cancellation that went on there. Certainly there are isolated incidents, but the BDS movement traces back 20 years now. And anti-Israel sentiment on campuses, I mean, it goes back into the 1970s at least. So it had presence on a number of campuses. So yes, the power has shifted. I think I'm just hesitant to put the Zionists, even in the time when they had the power, sort of as perpetrators of cancel culture. That's where I'm resisting there. But that could be a topic for another conversation.
Well, I think everybody cancels everyone if they can. I mean, everybody wants power. That's something this has made really clear to me. Like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, if you'd been like, oh yeah, the, you know, trans activists are going to take power, I'd be like, that's great. I can't think of anyone I'd rather have. The sweet trannies. I love the trannies. they're so cool. And it's like, wow, this is freaking horrifying.
Right. Well, you know, everyone loves power, but I don't know that everyone wants to cancel everyone else. I mean, just you know, again, the language, the platform of the BDS movement today is to silence the Zionist voice. And the Zionist voice certainly will disagree. The only time they start wanting to silence is when people have crossed the line from an argument and a position to really inciting violence and expressing hate. Go back to that term, right? There's a difference between disagreeing and basically inciting and supporting violence.
But you have to admit there have been a lot of Zionists who are very quick to feel terribly, terribly threatened if people talked about stuff, right? That they would go straight to the like, oh my God, they want to kill me.
I think many will feel that way. But yeah, in terms of their behavior on campuses, there's really a difference between advocating for the Palestinians and advocating against Israel, calling for the destruction of Israel. Those are very different things. And what's called pro-Palestinian advocacy is 98% of the time on campuses really anti-Israel advocacy. And that's a big difference. And that's a hostility which is problematic on campus. I don't think any Zionist on a campus would have a problem with someone who is generally advocating for Palestinians. And we, you know, that's an important distinction I can elaborate on, probably not tonight now, but advocating for people is always great, right? We're support. You should advocate for everybody, advocate for lots of people. But when you're actually advocating against some people, well, that's more problematic on a campus. So, and I think that's what would characterize today's campus scene, that what's called pro-Palestinian advocacy is really anti-Israel and ultimately anti-Jewish activism. And that's why it's problematic. But they have the power. So they're, you know, and they are trying very hard to literally silence and eliminate Zionists. I published a book a few years ago. I'm showing it even though we're not on video, but anti-Zionist, just happen to have it here, anti-Zionism on campus, which is documenting, came out in 2018. There's 32 chapters documenting, some of them are real horror stories about people being attacked for just standing up for Israel. So I think that's where the power is. But the point is not just that it's in power, it's the power is being used to really silence this voice, as opposed to the other way around, which is if you're going to advocate, we're happy to hear you, but it's only when you cross this line, admittedly not the clearest line sometimes, but when you cross this line into advocating against something and against Jews, well, that's the problem.
I'd like to find an intersection here of these ideas, and that is that in 2017, the Chicago Lesbian March banned the display of Jewish pride flags as being offensive to people. So a Jewish pride flag would be it was this old fashioned thing that displayed the rainbow on the flag.
That's right.
Instead of a rainbow and one quarter of a swastika, it displays a rainbow flag with a Star of David on
right.
it. And that was banned by the organizers of the march because they didn't want to offend the sensibilities of anybody who might have to tolerate Jews being visible right. at a pride march.
Yeah, and there's several episodes like that. So Women's March, Dykes March, I think, and certainly episodes on campus, same sort of thing, where simply students from Hillel not being allowed. There was a, speaking of trans, Janet Mock, who's a well-known activist, right? Trans activist, was invited to come to Brown University a few years back, and a bunch of student groups were sponsoring it, including the LGBTQ group at Brown University. Hillel was one of the co-sponsors. Students for Justice in Palestine at Brown started a whole campaign to get Janet Mock to disavow the sponsorship of the Hillel, the Jewish students. And now what's, you know, important to keep in mind is this has initiated nothing to do with Israel, right? This was trans rights, trans activism. These Jewish students, part of Hillel, shared the agenda of these progressive students, this LGBTQ agenda. But because they were Jewish, they were part of Hillel, SJP ran this campaign, and Janet Mock very disgracefully, instead of saying, you know, I'm for anybody who supports, you know, my platform, she decides she canceled her visit. She said, I don't want to cause controversy, instead of standing up and saying it's outrageous to demand the Jews withdraw from this cause. But so there's lots of instances like that where Jewish students are being excluded from progressive causes on campus. Also, Black Lives Matter is a big issue as well, because Black Lives Matter is just, you know, viciously anti-Israel in its platforms and in many of its practices. And you have so many Jewish students on campuses who are good, left-leaning, progressive students. They really care about Black Lives Matter. But when Black Lives Matter, you know, has a point in their platform, and then they put out some really vicious tweets this past spring, you know, condemning Israel and siding with the Palestinians, how does a Jewish student like throw their lot in with that cause? They're basically being told, you know, check your Judaism at the door. And that's the scene we have on campuses. And it's very, very distressing.
So is it possible to be agnostic about Zionism? Is it possible to be agnostic about Israel? Because that's how I see myself. And right. with making this land is mine.
Yeah.
A bunch of people said like, oh, this is a Zionist propaganda. And then other people were like, this is so anti-Zionist. This
Who
is
saw that as Zionist propaganda?
some of
my lens was, if anything, anti-Zion, but I thought it was bigger than an anti, right? It was a profound comment on the human condition. I thought that.
Well, I think some Zionists thought it was anti-Zionist, and
yeah,
I think
right.
some anti-Zionists thought it was Zionist. So that's good, right? I was like, okay, this is good. Both sides, terrific. You know,
well, apparently everyone
I'm pissing off everybody.
Right, everyone sees it through their lens, right?
Which yeah,
is our earlier starting point.
But I like at a screening, somebody said, "Look, you have to take some position, right? Like you can't. You have to have like you have to be rooting for someone or the other. Come on." And I said, well, I'm rooting for the land, because that was my
yeah.
approach to all of this, was to think of before, yeah. you know, prior to Abrahamism and the planet underneath it. But it is really chilling for me to acknowledge actual anti-Semitism on the left. It is a bit sickening, right? Because
right.
I've lived a life of privilege where, you know, I've always been Jewish. My family's always been Jewish. It's never been an issue in the town I grew up in. For me, being Jewish mostly meant just that we weren't Christian. When I was young, I thought Jewish was actually meant that you don't believe in God, because my family didn't believe, we were atheists, but my parents didn't use the word atheist. They were just like, you're Jewish. And then I like was exposed to all this sort of pro-Israel propaganda, and a family members are like, you should go to Israel. And I was like, why? Like, I don't have anything to do with Israel. Why would right. I go there? I can be Jewish here. And it got like more and more political, and friends, you know, I met this woman who was like a real Zionist, and she said Jews that were self-hating Jews. And I was classified as a self-hating right. Jew. And I mean, I certainly don't want to disavow my history, my family's history. I think I can be a Jew without
right.
being an active Zionist, but I also don't want to destroy the state of Israel, because it already exists and people live there.
Right.
If I could go back in time, I would have advocated something else. It's an intractable mess, which is something that my father said when I was interviewing him at the hospital before he died. I was like, what do you think about Israel? And he just said, like, it's a mess. It's just a mess. And it's like, this is an unsolvable, intractable problem. So I have no solution, because I see no solution.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable on the, you know, far, far away from it. And my comfortable, privileged life in the United States, where I'm very, very glad my ancestors settled.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, yeah, I just wanted to say those things.
Well, first of all, I loved your father in your film. He's what a great character. And your animation of him was, I assume that was your father, right? The father.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, God the Father.
Just, it was fantastic. And I'm sorry to hear that he's passed. That's
Oh, fair. Yeah. No, he died. He died a couple months after I did that recording, and then I finished the film 5 years later.
Oh my goodness. Oh, okay. You know, well, for my, I, to me, he was alive in my mind. I just watched the film a few weeks ago. Right. So it's, so sorry to hear that news. So yes, is what I'll say to what you just said.
I mean, I want to be able to talk about this stuff without, you know, without freaking people out and without people, you know, saying that I want to destroy Israel, but I also don't want to destroy the Palestinian. I mean, I think there's an excellent argument for the Palestinians. And I just think that it's like there's a mess, a knot. It's a Gordian knot. It's not fixable.
So, you know, I hope we'll meet over beer someday and have long conversation on this, because I everything you're saying is important and true, and I get it. And, you know, I'm actually teaching a course on Zionism and anti-Zionism right now. And my own preferred acronym, my own preferred way of describing the conflict, it's the Israeli-Palestinian Jewish-Arab-Muslim-Christian conflict, right? And that leaves out important players, including United States and Russia and Europe, right? It is, and I feel, at least from where I am now as an educator, that if I have a student leaving my course being able to say, oh, it's complicated, then that's a victory, because oversimplifying is a terrible, terrible danger. When you oversimplify, you become maybe the pure unadulterated Zionist or the pure unadulterated anti-Zionist. And the reality is this conflict is really profoundly complicated. And the more you study it, the more complicated it is. It's a mess, in the technical term that your father used, right? It is a mess. And I don't know what the solution is. And most people have no idea what the solution is, including the players themselves. So, you know, if you don't, you're not going to choose your side based on the solution that you think is, because no one knows what the solution is. What I will say, I'll say a couple of things that are relevant to, can you be agnostic? Well, on the one hand, of course you can be. It's incredibly complicated. So I don't know who's right and who's wrong or what the right resolution should be. So maybe the appropriate epistemic position will be, I don't know, I'm neutral, right? And you have to respect that, because that's a very reasonable position to be in. But there are a couple of things to keep in mind, which I think do motivate some people who side with the Zionists, at least, which is, I think the following is true with respect to the conflict. The Jews, by and large, would be okay sharing this land. They'd be okay with the Palestinian state as long as the Palestinians didn't want to kill them. And what stops the two-state solution isn't for many Jews. Of course, there's lots of different people and parties involved. But for, I think, the significant majority of Israelis, if they believe the Palestinians were ready for peace, they would split the land tomorrow. There'd be a two-state solution and it would be done. So what resists, what keeps Israelis and Jews in particular from accepting that, is they don't believe the Palestinians want peace. Right. So in principle, they're really open to what we would see as a peaceful resolution, a fair resolution, something like a two-state solution. Whereas the other side, I really do believe overwhelmingly, and surveys show this, and certainly the leadership is this, the Palestinians don't want a two-state solution. They want to destroy Israel. So it's important to keep that in mind as you're trying to figure out, should I side with somebody in the debate? So intellectually, it's complicated. So who knows who's right? But in practical terms, who should you side with when people are fighting here? Well, I think the Jews want peace and partition, and the Palestinians want destruction. I do believe that. And the second point to keep in mind is, I used to have a running sort of funny debate with one of my colleagues about whether a pogrom or a Holocaust or a pogrom was possible in the United States. And he said no, and I said yes. That would be a surprisingly complicated debate. It was a semi-humorous debate, but you know, the no side is America, everything's good here, Jews are successful here, we're well integrated, blah, 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 blah. My response was, I don't think it could happen tomorrow, but it could happen really quickly. Like if the right set of world events happened, I think the United States could turn on its Jews like overnight. And I think we've seen a little bit of that when Hamas is attacking Israel. What happens? We saw in this past May, if you were following this, Jews were being physically assaulted on the streets of major cities in the United States, dozens and dozens of episodes. And that's apart from the ongoing anti-Semitic assault that's going on all the time. I mean, synagogues being vandalized and Jewish stores being vandalized and Jews being assaulted in Brooklyn, like almost every single day, barely makes the news now. So, you know, the right external circumstance, a war, could show that the Jew hatred in the United States, it never disappears. It's not there. It's there. It's beneath the surface, and the right events could trigger it. And I think we saw that in May, the beginning of May. And had that war gone on longer, it would have gotten worse. The point of that being, the Jew that you've just described yourself, which of course, that's a great Jew. Why not? I mean, you feel proud of your Jewishness. You're not denying that. You might not have a choice. They're going to come for you too. When they come for the Jews, they're coming for you. And so, if you put those two points together, like my analysis of the scene over there and the fact that your Jewishness is going to condemn you when they're ready to come for the Jews, maybe that's an argument to say, you know what, as long as they're going to come get me anyway, I might as well fight for this thing. And that to fight for this thing is really to fight for Israel, because that is the only hope of long-term security for the Jews. So every part of that you could easily contest and argue with, but that's, you know, I understand the personal position of being agnostic. And it's respectable, again, because the situation is so unbelievably complex. Like, do I know that the Jews are right and the Palestinians are wrong? Like, very, very, very complicated. But in fact,
one of the things,
yeah, go on.
One of the things I noticed is when those attacks against Jews were happening this spring, it was immediately on the heels of a month-long campaign that was called Stop Asian Hate.
Yeah,
there were a lot of celebrities and hashtags, and I'm in IT. I couldn't even log into Amazon with their web services without having a login message that faced me.
Yeah,
reminding me as a computer programmer that I need to stop Asian hate.
Right.
And then there were a couple of notable acts of violence against Jews who were not doing anything except for being visibly Jewish in public.
Yeah.
And I didn't see any sort of, I saw some people pointing out the irony that there was no backlash or right, response, right. But besides that, there was no like stop Jewish hate.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, in Jewish circles, there was, and there was even a rally over the summer, which drew almost nobody, what was it called? Say no to hate, or, you know, some slogan like that on the mall in Washington. It's okay to hate on Jews. I mean, it really, yeah. You'll occasionally get lip service about that it's bad. And people will say we're including some of the worst haters of Jews, like a Linda Sarsour or a Rashida Tlaib, for example. You know, they're against anti-Semitism. But again, the only anti-Semitism they recognize is, like with the ADL, is the white supremacist anti-Semitism, because of course they're against white supremacists. What they don't recognize is that years of piling on this Israel hatred waters the ground for Jew hatred, for obvious reasons. And, you know, and people, surprisingly number of people, it's not just that they didn't vocally campaign against stopping Jew hate, it's that I think in a lot of people's, even decent people's minds, like which are hopefully the majority of people, it's like, well, of course they're beating up the Jews because look what Israel's doing, right? And that itself is such a profoundly anti-Semitic attitude to have. But I think that's why beating up on the Jews just didn't trouble a lot of people, because they felt like, well, they sort of deserve it. Or I can understand why someone would do it, even if I myself am not out there. It's understandable because Israel. But the only reason they have that attitude is because of just years of this anti-Israel vitriol, which is 98% either unfounded or distorted. That's a separate conversation. To hate on Israel is to hate Jews. So that's a third reason maybe to become a Zionist, even if in your heart you don't feel it, which is the attack on Israel is an attack on Jews. And therefore, they're going to come for you, too. You might not be the first one, you know, brought off to the gas chamber, but you'll be in the second or third load, you know. So
something I thought about with my scapegoat being a scapegoat was I thought, like, is it me? I mean, I realize that this is meeting the needs of a community, of a screwed up community, that I'm a lightning rod. But like, am I doing something? Because I've been a scapegoat a lot. And like, why does this keep happening? Because there are some people that go through their whole lives without being a scapegoat. And of course, I also, you know, then I think about like the ending of your book and what you said at the beginning of this, which is how ideologies distort anybody, including possibly the narrator of that book.
Right.
And, you know, Judaism is definitely an ideology and Zionism is an ideology. So you can be a victim and still participate in the dance, you know, like and of course Jews have written about Jews as scapegoats repeatedly, like, well, no matter where we go, no matter what we do, we're always in this situation for some reason. For some reason, people are always scapegoating us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. Yeah. How does this keep happening? And I mean, I don't know, but I am willing in my personal life to consider things that I am comfortable in the role of scapegoat.
Yeah.
And that is one reason that I keep performing the public service of being a scapegoat.
Oh, that's so good of you. What a service. They don't pay you enough for that. That's
And I have the privilege of having enemies that I can feel victimized by, I love my enemies because they enable me to maintain my identity.
Yeah.
As a victim, which maybe anyway, I just wanted to say those things that it might not just be me. There,
yeah,
it could be a bigger thing. And I know that I know that this has been discussed by many a Jew for a while. So
yeah, well, I do have to wrap up. This was so much fun, and I hope we can connect again in the future. But I hope we can connect in person sometime because this was a lot of fun. I think we have a lot more to talk about. I appreciate the time. This was good for me. I don't think if you don't mind mentioning, I don't know if you put a little promo in, just, you know, say the name of the book a few times, because, you know, I don't think I managed to squeeze it in enough there. And you can mention my website, which is andrewpessin.com. Which, if anyone's interested in the book, that's where they can find more about it. Because, you know, one of the goals is to promote the book, of course. But in any case, this was so much fun, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Me too. And the book is Nevergreen.
Nevergreen. And it can be found at andrewpessin.com for those who might be interested.
Well, TERFs and Trannies, thank you for joining us tonight. You listened to two Jews and one tranny who's definitely not Jewish.
Excellent.
Please check out Andrew's book, and you'll catch us next time on Heterodorks.
So long, perps and trannies.